Blog Talk Radio.
There we are. We are live now. Okay, there we go. I guess we should get going. Okay, now I'm not on live. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you may be throughout this world or here in Canada, but wherever you are, welcome to today to Personal Transformation. My name is Stuart Thompson. I'm obviously broadcasting from home, which you look at, if you look at my background, that's really not my home. It's really, really fictitious because I'm in the midst of a move right now, and I don't want to show you what I'm really in for. But folks, thank you for joining me today. It brings me great honor. Today, I have Tom Ernst here with me today, and I'm going to give you a brief bio, reading from his book, by the way, The Wild Boys of Wabimic. And I've had the pleasure of reading this book, and again, I also have the honor of having Tom here with me today. So I'm going to give you a brief bio, and just, folks, just so you know, this is being broadcasted on Blog Talk Radio, Spotify, and also StreamYard. And later on, it will be uploaded and put into YouTube as well as part of the Gatehouse media plan. So if you're trying to find us, that's where you can find us. But also, we are on Twitter Live right now as well. Folks, Tom. Tom is a Toronto-based film critic and writer and an active member of the Toronto Film Critic Association. Has written work on film, has appeared in various publications. Tom is perhaps the best remembered as the host and interviewer, producer of the television longest running movie program, Saturday Night at the Movies, which I watched right from Ellery right to you and moving forward. Tom's also been involved with and on Bell Media's Making Movies and The Canadian Way. Currently, Tom's film reviews to be read on Original Sin or Northern Stars. You can also be heard interviewing Canadian filmmakers on the Canadian Film Festival podcast. Rewind, fast forward, The Wild Boy would be, of course, Tom's book, which we're talking about here today. So I hope I paid you justice by reading that. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Well, first...
I'll just say it's the enunciation of the town is difficult.
Wabimic, right?
Wabimic.
Wabimic, okay. Thank you for correcting me on that.
Yeah, no, I think if the town fathers heard you say that, they'd go, yeah, let's change it to that.
Yeah, that's because I'm white in English, and it's probably an Indian name I'm taking. That's where it came from, correct?
Yeah, it's an indigenous name.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's from around the Perry Sound area.
Yeah. Marvelous. So again, welcome here again today, Tom. You know, before we get started, folks, I was so drawn into this book, and I loved, obviously it talks about your history of abuse, but I love what you've done with it, and adding humor, adding a beautiful storyline. And by the way, are you still a Bruins fan?
No.
Okay. Yeah. I just had to ask you that.
But anyway, yeah.
But anyway, folks, I'm going to get Tom to read a passage from his book, and then we'll get started on. So, folks, Tom, it's in your court. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Stuart, and thank you for inviting me on your podcast. I know what good work you do outside of the podcast. So
thank
it's
you.
Great to see that you're doing that online as well, and you're reaching people. I understand. Not just in Canada, all around the world.
Absolutely. Which this is the beautiful thing about what I'm doing. And, and one thing about the healing process of what we do is about making connection with others. And that's been a huge part of it. And thank you for mentioning that.
Okay. So I'm going to read a little part here. I've always liked reading this bit when I'm doing a public reading or something. So hopefully you'll enjoy it too. Okay. It's from chapter 5 of the book, A Wild Boy of Wabimic. I was 4 when I was first told about my adoption. I took the news surprisingly well, mostly because when Mom sat me in the kitchen, handed me a carton of animal cookies, and told me that I was adopted, I thought she said I was a doctor. I knew enough about doctors to know that they could be imposing and impressive creatures of authority, and I was okay with that. But as I worked through the box of animal cookies, biting off the heads of giraffes and lions, with Mom telling me how lucky I was and that there were hundreds of boys and girls without mummies and daddies who would give their right arm to be in my shoes, Mum would have had quite the impressive collection of body parts. For all the limbs people would have given to be as lucky as me. I became less enamored with the idea. I imagined an image stolen directly from the pages of my children's Bible book. They're generic, rosy-cheeked children who, for no discernible reason, faced west with their heads tilted towards the sky, stood aimlessly with a ray of light as if the world was not enough for them. Motherless children, lost but pure and entirely holy. Where are their mummies, I asked. I could tell my question pleased Mum, if only because it indicated that some of what she was saying was beginning to sink in. Well, she replied, some of their mothers died. The notion of a dead mother horrified me. Did my mummy die, I asked? No, your mummy was too young to care for you properly, and God knows where your father took off to. There it was, the resentment resonating in my mother's voice towards lost fathers, the fathers who chose to be lost, which I understood to include my own, villains unworthy of concern or curiosity.
Oh, that's awesome. I really enjoyed that part, too, especially I knew right away when you talked about the cookies. I remember when I was reading that part in Chapter 5. That was just awesome. Thank you for doing so. And another kind of a beginning of the book question that I wanted to ask you, too, as well, along with, like, I asked you about the Boston question. By the way, who is your favorite hockey team, by the way, now?
Toronto Maple Leafs.
Toronto Maple Leafs.
I'm a Toronto boy. I'm here in Toronto, and it took me a while to get on the bandwagon, but now that I'm on, boy.
Well, I'm still working on that. Getting off track here a little bit, but my very first hockey team I saw was the Montreal Canadiens, so I am still a Montreal Canadiens fan.
Yeah. You know, if you live in this area of Canada, you're going to be either a Habs, a Sens, or a Leaf fan. Okay.
And at one point, it would have been Quebec North as well, but they're gone.
Yeah. That's right.
So, thank you. Another part in your book, I know in the beginning of your book, you talked about how you started loving movies and pictures, that sort of thing. Well, originally, in the book, you mentioned that you love Clint Eastwood movies. Are you still into Clint Eastwood movies, even though they're...
My opinion of Clint Eastwood movies has changed considerably. As a film critic, I think he peaked at Mystic River, which is a book that deals with child abuse on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, not to get into politics because that's not what this podcast is about, and it doesn't matter what your politics are when we're dealing with child abuse.
Man.
Down and interview him, I wouldn't hesitate.
Mm. You know, I don't know what happened here, Tom. I'm already having technical difficulties, but I lost you for 10 seconds. Mm. I don't think it went off, but we're still here.
Lost you.
Yeah, well, I'm here. I'm going to put myself back. There we go. I think it's the internet's just acting weird, and hopefully it'll work for us today. But, I got that part pretty much. I think I heard your vocal, your audio, no problem. What do you think changed that persona of your thought of Clint Eastwood? Is it just growing up and becoming a film critic, or what do you think that kind of changed you on that? I mean, even myself, I mean, I don't know as much about Clint Eastwood as you would, because obviously that's the type of thing you do, but all I know is as a kid growing up, and we're pretty much the same age, he was my hero, but now, don't know.
I think, you know, even when we look back at the films we liked probably when we were kids, like, yeah, I'm going to assume you were a Dirty Harry fan.
Yep.
And you know, I think growing up, we become aware that rogue cop idea, which is really a very sort of almost fascist look at police. Now that we look at police and we talk about brutality, you know, the image of making guys like Dirty Harry a hero is just, it's confusing. It doesn't fit in today's narrative.
Mm.
So I think, you know, and people could say, well, that was that era. You know, back then, that was okay. Well, it wasn't okay back then. And if you read certain critics of that time, like Pauline Kael,
mm-hmm.
he never liked them for this reason. And Pauline Kael, for those who don't know, is one of the great giants in film criticism, and one of the only women in film criticism, and certainly probably the first to stand up. So I remember as a kid reading Pauline Kael, and I'm going, what's the matter with you? You're being uptight. But now as an adult, and I understand about the police brutality, I understand about, you know, keeping things within a realm of, you know, decency and inclusiveness, et cetera. And I'm not even speaking from a far left perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking about general, you know, good behavior. And certainly Clint Eastwood doesn't represent that. Saying that, the film can still be a lot of fun. You just have to kind of throw your better sense out the window.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, because, you know, I mean, I think this is where a lot of people, and again, this may seem a little off track, but not really, because it's kind of what we're talking about. People's perception of actors are all over the place, and what we see and what we hear are always two different things. And then what we hear from the critics versus what we see from, well, I guess there's several different variations of critics, but who am I to know about that and anything about that? But I was very interested. Anyway, I want to say thank you. It was very interesting here from your perspective and also educating me in a manner a little further. But I want to move on to your book now. Thank you. So reading through your book, and I pretty much seen you go pretty much right from a very young man all the way up to where you are now. And I guess really the first question would be, well, what brought you to write this book to begin with? Because one, there's a couple of things that would be, I would think would be in your way. One of them, first thing being, would be a man. And number two would be, I'm a man, but this abuse happened to me. And you, like me, we were brought up not to talk about it. And, you know, and in your book, you talk about secrecy quite heavily, and which will enlighten, we'll talk a little bit more about. But to those two things that I brought up, where are you coming from that?
Okay, well, I think there's so much to unpack there, because first of all, what got me, I didn't want to write this book, and I actually, as a kid, was
mm-hmm.
terrified that I would come to a point in my life where I would be okay with telling someone about the abuse,
mm-hmm.
that I would talk about it. And as a kid, there was nothing more horrifying than being found out. Because I never saw this as my father's crime or sin.
Mm-hmm.
I always saw it as mine. And now I think, I think this is not a straight gay issue.
Yeah.
But it, to some people, I mean, it's going to look like that. And I think because the LGBTQ community has worked so hard to normalize, they are norm, it
mm-hmm.
is normal, and it should be normalized,
mm-hmm.
but LGBTQ community, the ground that they have made it easier for our guys like us to say, this is what happened to me, because it's not a gay thing. It's not. The stigma is erased. And there's that. So there's also the idea that one day, and it was Remembrance Day,
mm-hmm.
or coming up to, and my niece, who I adore, posted a picture of her grandfather, which was my dad, and my dad was my abuser.
Mm.
Posted a picture of him as a, in his World War II uniform.
Yeah.
And everyone was commenting how handsome he was, how great he was, and what an honor it was, and I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle this man being publicly adored, even though it was just on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Just comment. And I thought about it and reached out to my niece and told her that I'm finding this very difficult to see. And she immediately took it down. You know, she had no idea. And so that made me aware that this story has to come out, because obviously it is eating me from the inside out. It's affecting my relationships. It's affecting everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I just needed to get that story out. So those were two of the reasons. I don't think I ever really adopted the idea that my story could be helpful to anyone else. I don't think I could go in with that kind of attitude. So I don't make you know, I don't write about solutions and how to get over it in the book. As a matter of fact, if you when you read the book, you might go, well, he doesn't explain how he got from, you know, from where he was to where he is, other than just good relationships with people. And that's because I don't think one solution fits all. So I'm not going to go, you know, I went to therapy, that was a big part, but everyone's going to find their own way out. It's just make sure you understand it's not your fault. Make sure you understand that, you're kind of weak in this moment. You're going to blame yourself and that there are ways to get yourself out of it. You'll find your way.
Yeah, and one thing I really did notice, and this is why I would encourage people to read your book, especially other male survivors, is that throughout your whole book, maybe, I don't know, I noticed this, but throughout your whole book, you had an incredible amount of resiliency that seemed to carry you forward and forward. Even in the shitty days, you seemed to find a way to find your way out of it, whether it be through humor or with your buddy Doug.
Doug's crazy, man. but I didn't clearly think well of myself at the time. But you know what? I think children are resilient. But again, I'm careful saying that because you know, oh, they'll bounce back. No, the trauma of abuse or any kind of trauma, but we're talking specifically here about sexual trauma, is devastating. Is absolutely devastating. So somehow there was something about me, and I don't know what it was, whether it was my friend Doug, who was a, you know, a big goof and made me laugh all the time, whether it was film. I think, you know, I like to say, though, that film came from a really good place because and not a bad place. But resilience, I suppose, but I couldn't answer how or why. Something that happened. I had a wonderful older sister who adored me, and I adore her. She's still with us. And friends. Resilient. But I will confess it wasn't easy, and I didn't always like myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, and I can really appreciate that struggle coming from the same experience, being abused as a child. You know, to find the resiliency and it is really, really hard. But the reason why I point that out is, like I said, I see it in the book, right? You know, how you turn a shitty situation into a thing and you turn it into humor. Well, it appears so in the book anyway, as I read it. So that's what I'm really, really enjoying about it. Yeah, it's pretty damn awful. But at the same time, you kept living and you kept doing and you kept trying and you did whatever you could to distract yourself from what was happening at home. Best you could. And, you know, most children going through this, they really struggle with this. And you know, yes, I'm mentioning resiliency, but I think a lot of times we don't recognize that in ourselves and how we cope and how we struggle. So that's why I thought I'd point that out, that anybody reading it will see that as you're going through. Yes, your resiliency, yes, is maybe displayed through your humor. So that's where I kind of picked that up, right?
Interesting. Yeah, because you're absolutely right, Stuart. I do not see where that resilience came. When I look back at the child I was, I see someone who was scared, someone who was too weak to speak out.
Mm-hmm.
I see someone who acted out inappropriately. I also saw someone who manipulated the situation to get what they wanted. And that I think is the most difficult takeaway from abuse. But it was so consistent in my life, and it lasted about a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so consistent that it became the norm.
Mm.
And the only thing that I was concerned about eventually was making sure that nobody found out.
Yeah, yeah. And again, we're coming back to secrecy. And I'm sure a lot of us other CSA survivors or childhood sexual abuse survivors can say the same thing. Like, I mean, I know my background, my secrecy lived with me until I went to the gatehouse 13 years ago. And whenever I did talk about it, it was usually, you know what, you're a man, you know, you can't talk about that. I've even had some experiences where I've had my ex, a girlfriend, for example, or I've had a couple of ex-girlfriends, for example, who had the same experience. But then again, they did the same thing with me. They, you know, it was just the way we were brought up. Even them, I'm not holding them to fault other than they didn't acknowledge me. And they thought because I was a male that I should be tough and I should be over this already. Because wherever they were in their head spot, right?
Yeah, that is an experience that happens again and again and again. And this idea, well, even as a 12-year-old, mm-hmm. I called the helpline.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I read that in the book, yes.
Yeah, and they basically told me to, you know,
yeah,
fuck off, pull up your socks,
yeah.
Get over it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you're embarrassed and you go, okay, I get, you know, I'm sorry. And then you feel weaker and you feel like... you feel victimized again, but you feel like it's your fault you're the victim.
Yeah. See, that's why I was asking you why, as a male, you know, those sort of stigmas, were they kind of in play for you writing this book because of the stigma I'm kind of talking about?
Not while writing it, because by the time I was writing the book, I had a lot of years to process this, a lot of therapy and discussions. I still ran into girlfriends who could basically say, you know, you gotta man up. And I don't even think my wife understood 100%.
Yeah.
Until the book was out.
Mm-hmm.
So writing the book, I didn't feel that. Writing the book, I felt justified. But I also did. Maybe I'm perpetuating the image, because when writing the book, I thought, I do not want a book that was poor me.
Yeah.
You want to write that book.
Yeah.
And you know what? If you do write that book, you're allowed. You know, that's justifiable. That's also totally acceptable. But for me, I wanted to write a book that was a journey, that was a story, and that... I didn't want to push the buttons to say, cry for me,
you
know, feel bad for me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell it like it was. And so maybe I'm continuing on by perpetuating that image that you have to be tough. I don't think I wrote a character who was tough.
No.
I merely wrote a character who was going through this and had to find his way out. A lot of stuff I left out. I did have, a drug issue for a long time, an alcohol issue for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I had promiscuity for a long time. So all these things, you know, I just didn't put it in the book because that's not what the book was about. But I knew that I would have the opportunity to talk about it. To people who are interested.
Mm. Yeah, well, thank you for mentioning that. And I'm really glad you mentioned about the three so-called nullers, the drugs, the alcohol, promiscuity, because a lot of survivors, we have that issue. And obviously, we not all of us talk about it. I mean, I talk about it quite openly because that's been my experience, but I only talk about it just so people understand that they're not alone. This is part of it. And that's how you coped.
That's exactly, and that's what you need.
Yeah.
That can never be sort of downplayed.
No, not at all.
How important it is to know you are not alone. And it's sad to know we are not alone, because that means that there are people that, it is rampant, sexual abuse. And it is, a lot of people can justify it. That's why I'm reluctant to talk about resiliency, because some people can justify it by saying, oh, they'll get it over it.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's a poor damn excuse to meet your own needs, to betray innocence, to meet your own needs. I think when you know that, yeah, these things like the drug, it's not an excuse to spend all your money on drugs and leave your family in the poorhouse, which, by the way, that wasn't my case, but... just do all these things. I mean, you have to get control of it, but these are things that do happen. These are things that do occur. Your struggle is real, and you came by them because of this, and there's nothing innately wrong with you.
Mm.
you just have to be aware of it, and you have to act accordingly.
Mm. You know, thank you for saying that. So, you know, leading up to your book, like, did you remember when you first put it in your head and said, "Damn it, I'm tired of this, and I want to write it down, and I want to tell the world."
I think my intent was to write a fictional book about these things, with the hopes that somebody would ask me after the fictional book was done, is this based on a true story? Is this based on your life? And then I could take it from there.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very much encouraged by my agent and by my acquiring editor at Dunder & Press, who his name is Russell Smith, a well-known writer. And I was reluctant, you know, because I didn't want my name in there. I didn't want my sister's names in there. I didn't want them to go through the relive their trauma. But so what happened the first time, I've always knew I was going to write this book, but my reluctancy was, I want to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be the poster child for childhood sexual trauma.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I may not have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, this is the role that maybe my life will take, and that's okay. If I think that my story is effective to others, then I do it wholeheartedly, and can't wait for the opportunity. But more so than ever, when I decided I was going to write this book, I reached out to my sisters, one who embraced it, because she felt it was essential for me. And the other one who didn't want anything to do with it. So I changed her name in the book, although in real life I only have two sisters, and one is named by her other name. So anybody who knows us is going to go, oh, I wonder who this Anna is that I've never heard of. Just a sidetrack about including other people in my story, because people have said, you have a right to tell your story, but you have a right to tell your sister's. And I don't tell their story.
Yeah.
I tell my story, they're in it, you know. And the idea, and still, you know, my one sister would love for me to have kept this a secret still.
Mm-hmm.
The quotes are there because it's not a secret. You know, but she would have liked me to keep it quiet. And I had a very good therapist who said, well, didn't you keep it, because my sisters are much older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, didn't you keep it quiet for like 40 years, 50 years? My sisters, one is 80, one is 75. So most of their life, they were able to live, without people knowing. Now people know, but I don't tell their experience. I don't tell how they react to things.
Yeah.
I simply acknowledge that they are part of the story.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. You know, see, I think a lot of people don't get this. And again, I don't mean to sound like I'm stereotyping or anything like that, because that's not what I want. This is just merely an observation I've noticed. And this is with the work that I do at the Gatehouse. Now, a lot of people I've noticed, I'm gonna start from, I'll say from, well, okay, the baby boomers. I'll just emphasize on that. I won't go Generation X or anything lower than that. But the baby boomers, and me being one as well, I've noticed, granted that's changing, but it's really hard, and the way our values, the way we're brought up, this was never talked about. And to see someone older talking about it, like if you were to go to Gates, as an example, and where I'm there, and I see this all the time, I would say the majority of the people who come in and do groups are well under 60, and majority, and anybody over 60, it's usually a very, very small number. And granted, the numbers change all the time. It really depends what's going on. But the way we're brought up and the conversation is still very, very hard to do. And granted, like I said, maybe the younger generation are helping the boomers come in and talk about this. I have no idea. But when I look at, if I use numbers, for example, our numbers for anybody over 60 is very low in comparison to anybody under. And I know there's lots of people out there that have had this experience, like as far as baby boomers are concerned. And I've met lots of them over the years, but not as many as you might think have come through the house. I mean, don't get me wrong, the gatehouse, I'm sure we've had some pretty good numbers, but majority is, well, the majority are not baby boomers, is all I'm trying to say. So the reason why I'm mentioning this is that people need to understand that when we talk about generational trauma and, you know, not just carrying on, carrying it on, but where it started from, people don't understand how difficult it is to approach this and talk about this, or rather it's just to have that conversation. So there is no right conversation is my point, right? How do you talk about something like this? I have an older sibling sister to a stepsister, for example, and I won't say too much about that, but she witnessed some things and I won't even say her name. But the point being is, how do you get somebody to support you on this, whether you're a stepsister or your sister? So I guess basically what I'm getting at, or what I'm trying to say, is that the way we were brought up kind of brings that dividing line to whether I'm going to face it. I've lived with it all this time and I feel I'm good and I'm just going to keep moving. And maybe that's just the way it is. I don't know. I can't really figure it out, but it's just merely an observation.
Yeah, it's a very good observation. And I think you're completely correct in your assumptions about the age differential. I wonder, and I'm not an expert, and I'm throwing this out there, but do you think maybe the trauma of, like, we didn't go through World War II.
No.
Like, let's say your parents did. Now, that kind of trauma is so intense, or, you know, that maybe this one, it just doesn't add up for some people.
Yeah,
I think it does, because I think that sexual trauma can be a death sentence.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be. But certainly the stereotype of a man and victim, no man wants to be a victim.
Mm.
Nobody wants to be a victim, whether you're a man or a woman. Mm. But yeah, that was a ridiculous thing for me to say. But my point was, I think it's drilled into us that we're protectors.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's really as prevalent today. But certainly, even when I first started to speak out, which... You know, I have to say that a lot of my beating myself up through this is that I didn't speak out when I was young. I'm not so sure that would have been a good thing if I did. You know, I'm not so sure that wouldn't have backfired miserably. I would have been put back in a foster home, and I don't think I would have functioned very well there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what this story narrative would have been, but people weren't willing, I think, to hear. And I believe, I can't say that my mother knew. I don't know that for a fact, but I certainly suspect she knew. And I think the scene in the book, and I, you know, where I'm in the garage trying to build the birdhouse.
Yes.
And I'm accosted by my mother, and I have no idea what's going on. And I often wondered if that moment had to do with, did I say something to someone?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very possible that I did without even remembering.
Yeah.
But that's the response that I got. It was very negative, almost violent. You know, there was another point where my life was threatened, by my abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no reason to believe that they wouldn't have carried through with their threat.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. You know, I wasn't going to risk it.
Yeah.
And I felt like, you know, so does that answer your question? Because I think now people are talking about it. People are telling you, let someone know. You don't have to, you know, sit in silence. Children are not responsible. It doesn't matter if you're 12. Had somebody on a helpline say, you're 12, couldn't you have beaten them up? I could have handled myself at 12.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I couldn't handle myself at 12, even if nothing happened. I was a small dude.
Like myself? Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter if you're huge.
Yeah.
I could have been a linebacker in my high school. I don't know. I wouldn't have been in high school at 12. But it doesn't matter. The abuse and what it does to you doesn't. It limits you from internally. It doesn't limit you externally, you know? But internally, you become that small, selfless person, no matter what the exterior is presenting to the world.
So what would you tell somebody younger wanting to come forward and writing a book about their experience, like childhood sexual abuse? What would you tell somebody younger wanting to do that that doesn't have our life experience?
I don't know if I would actually recommend that they do write a book. I would recommend that they talk to someone.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that they talk to someone other than me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous saying, I don't know who said it. It's somebody everyone knows except me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, just because you have the disease doesn't mean you know the cure.
Mm.
So if somebody was to talk to me about sexual abuse and surviving it, et cetera, I could give them my life experience as much as, you know, I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't give them advice of what to do or what would be good for them. I think a young person without, this is just instinctually,
mm-hmm.
I think a young person without life experience might have a hard time finding a place for this story. When you say young, I'm assuming you mean very young, but if you're talking
young adults, young adults, let's say young adults,
that's different.
Yeah,
I think a perspective of a young adult would be very interesting, and you and I both hear those stories because of our connection. I'm involved with Gatehouse too.
Yeah,
I would like to be more involved, and hopefully that I can do that in the near future.
Absolutely, because the door is always open. You know that.
Yes, I do know that.
Yeah.
Quick diversion here.
Yeah.
I was recently at my doctor's office and talking about therapy and therapists. And even now with the book out and all the years of therapy and everything, all the work I've done, including work with Gatehouse, I still feel the need to continue working continue being under someone's care.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, during our discussion with this doctor, he said, you know, there's a place you should go to. It's called the Gatehouse, you know. And so the Gatehouse is so phenomenally connected with the sexual trauma community,
mm-hmm.
That professionals, like this guy's a psychiatrist and therapist, and they go to the Gatehouse. He was saying they do wonderful work. People have really progressed because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so happy to hear that. And I was also able to say, well, you know, I do go through the Gatehouse. It doesn't mean I stop everything else.
Yeah.
I do. But so anyway, my little tribute to the Gatehouse while I have you with me. I think the question was, would I recommend it to a kid, I was going to say that the stories we hear are from young adults,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the young males we hear from. And so their stories are interesting and their challenges are the same but different, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can't see myself as a mentor because I still feel very much a student,
mm-hmm.
but I think that hearing other people's stories are essential. Writing a book, I think you might have to find that way to write it in a book so that it's an experience that you can sort of download or the reader can download and translate as they will without, you know, just being, you know, given data and statistics and, you know, horror stories. Again, that may be what you have to do. I don't know. But my advice, if somebody wanted to write, was to find the story of the abuse and tell that.
Thank you. You know, because I'll give you a really good reason why I'm asking you this is because I often hear this. Like, for example, you're an inspiration for others to write books. And I've met other men and women, same thing, they've written books about their experiences. But I often hear this, younger people reading the book and go, oh, my gosh, I want to do the same thing, right? I want to talk about my experience to whatever way that they're capable or whatever capacity they have to do so.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I keep hearing that. Even myself, for example, like, you know, hell, I've probably got 400, 500 hours of talk about this subject, right? How do I turn around something like that into a memoir? But, you know, where do I start, right? So it's really, really inspiring for me when I see people like yourself and others out there doing this, but when I hear younger people wanting to do the same thing, and I have read a couple of books from younger people doing so, but definitely not in the context of what you've presented here. And keeping in mind, too, that no one's going to write the same book, and it's not always going to be the same, obviously, but the fact is that they tried to do it, and to whatever capacity they're able to do so, is very, very inspiring. Like the more I see people doing this, the more I want to do it myself. And again, I have a good basis to do it as well. So it'll be interesting to see if I follow through with it someday. But I guess my point being is that it's great to see young people doing this as well. And to bring the word out, because I know 10 years ago, there was very few books out about this topic, especially for men, period. Any books were out there. Go ahead.
I can tell you that when the book was making the rounds to publishers before Dundurn picked it up, a lot of the response I got was, if you're a hockey player or a politician, this book would sell.
Absolutely.
But since you're not, and I was the host of a TV show, but by the time this book was ready to go, I was no longer a host of a TV show, so that commodity was gone. The other thing I heard, and I found this kind of, I understand it, but I found it kind of upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we are in a Me Too era,
mm-hmm.
and because I wasn't a woman, it would sound like I'm looking for empathy in an area that women are gaining a foothold in.
Yeah.
It's not a competition, you know, and if it is a competition, I would choose a different event.
So
would
I. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I, it's also not about saying, I understand women, but now here's men, and it wasn't about that, and it was disappointing because I didn't want to feel like telling my story was robbing women of their story. But look at me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was careful to write it in as a story. But I have not talked to one woman who thought that my story was in any way downgrading or not validating their experience.
Yeah.
That, you know, I would not even venture forward with the story if I thought I was, invalidating someone else's experience.
You know, it's funny you mention that because with all the media stuff that I do, I never use Me Too because just to your exact same point. I'm a man, you're a woman. We're fighting the same cause, but I'm not going to jump on your bandwagon for my ass. Pardon the way I put
that's
that.
That's right. This is not a Me Too. Yeah. I am not a Me Too.
Me neither.
And neither am I, Black Lives Matter. I would never try to jump on board that. That's a very specific movement.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have a name for our movement, but I don't know if it needs one,
No, other than Me Too, I'm here. No, not Me Too, but rather I'm here anyway, but I don't know what we could call
there.
It. What, yeah.
Somebody will coin it up.
I'm sure they will, but I don't know. The new men's movement, I don't know, but it could be interesting, but. So,
I just think there's a humanizing that needs to be done,
mm-hmm.
and it's not jumping on anybody's bandwagon. I really do respect the Me Too movement. I really do respect the Black Lives movement. But I'm not going to not tell my story. I'm going to tell my story, and I'm going to tell it separately from these two situations. And I'm almost reluctant to, I started a blog and it fell to the wayside, and I think I'd like to start it again.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, the most response I got on that blog, in fact, maybe 100% of it, were all from women.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what that says. Maybe the male voices still feels like they have to be quiet. And if anything, women are stepping up and letting us know that they understand where we're coming from. They know the feeling. They know it all too well.
Mm. Yeah, I would tend to agree with you on that. Although I do believe the males coming forward, men coming forward, it's increased, right? And it's people like yourself that are helping with that along the way. You know, I mean, I really don't much care now, my age and that. I mean, I'm quite open about what I talk about. And, I mean, you can't hurt me any more than I've already been hurt already. So say what you want, whether I'm a man or not. I'm going to keep talking the way I'm talking, and I'm not going to stop, regardless.
Yeah.
But, it's, you know, very interesting you said about your blog, though. But, you know what, it doesn't surprise me, because when I go on social media, it's the same thing there. Like, you'll see that most audience, if there's a chat about it, it'll be women. And the percentage of men partaking in that, and I know I've done this lots of times myself, be like less than 1%, right?
Yeah.
That's horrible. But
yeah, this question needs to be talked about. I was in the process of writing this book and researching it and et cetera, and sharing over dinner with another couple, and a couple who've been friends of mine, the woman that's been friends of mine since first year university, mm-hmm. their husband. And I talked about my research and that about somebody I grew up with and how it shocked them when I told this. And the reaction from the husband was to throw up the table and say, why are you always talking about this? And so angry. And he yelled and screamed and stormed out. And it was frightening. And he just was so angry that I was talking about this. And I've had girlfriends and friends who are women that just say, this is all you talk about. It's not all I talk about.
Yeah.
I guarantee you it's not.
Yeah.
But when I do, it really makes some people very uneasy.
Mm.
I'll tell you something else that the publisher said when the book was being passed around, is they said that, and I think this is quite incorrect, only women read stories about sexual abuse.
Wrong.
Or abuse.
Wrong.
Wrong. And no woman is interested in reading about a man's experience.
Wrong. Yeah.
And I think my book is actually kind of proving that wrong. I think sales are doing very well. But that's
great to hear.
Go out and buy one.
Yeah. Great to hear that.
I hope that's the case. It's hard to sort of keep track of these things.
So it's been out now, what, about a month and a half now? The book's been out?
Yeah. So I had the book released first week of February.
Mm-hmm.
It was released January 31st from the publisher. We had two book launches, and I'm really happy to say one was in Toronto, mm-hmm. one was in Kitchener-Waterloo, and both we had to turn people away because they were packed.
Yeah, because I know even Art tried to get down there, but then we left at the last minute and we could not get in. But do you have any plans to go across the country, like to go out west or to go east with your book?
I'd like to go to, I'm talking to some people about doing Winnipeg, of which I've made some friends there. I have
awesome.
A friend who's a journalist there, and they have a very strong sexual trauma, childhood trauma abuse organization in that city.
Yep.
And also I made friends with Kevin McDonald.
Oh, wow.
You remember him from Kids of the Hall?
Yes,
and
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've been, I was at a film festival with him, and I introduced him on stage and did a little comedy bit, if you can believe
and
it.
And by the way, the Kids of the Hall are back, by the way, just so people know they're back.
They are back,
yes.
Yeah. And so I'm thinking I would love to do one in Winnipeg. I would love for this book to sort of, you know, catch on to some kind of zeitgeist. But, of course, that would mean great things for me personally,
mm-hmm.
financially, and also in my writing career.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly because I really do think that my experience so far is people have been really positively affected by this,
mm-hmm.
more so than I anticipated. And I really would like to keep that momentum going.
Mm. Now, I don't know.
Yeah, if, sure, would be great.
Yeah, that would be awesome because all I know is this needs to go all across Canada because there's such lack of resources and help for men out there. I mean, a lot of times the book is all you got, right? If you don't have internet, what else are you going to do to help heal yourself, right? So, it's very, very, very important. You know, one thing I wanted to mention, too, I don't know. I'll go back about, okay, let's say 10 years ago. Did you ever listen to Theo Fleury on CBC when he talked about childhood sexual abuse?
Yeah. Back then, I liked him.
Yeah.
Now I cannot stand the man.
Yeah. Well, with all due respect, I get. I mean, that's his own journey. But, you know, the reason why I'm bringing this up, and I think this is very, very important, is because he is the only male that I'm aware of in this time period, regardless of where he may be now. But I still commend him for going on his CBC and talking about this, regardless of where he is now. That's his own business. But and I can't say that I agree with it either. But nevertheless, he was the only male that I've ever heard of in Canada on live radio, well, actually national radio to be precise, CBC, talking about this. And I remember, one of my very first facilitators, Lee, was a guest on his show. So, but from then, I've never seen any other men doing this, whether it be, well, maybe in the States, I can't answer there, but in Canada, period. So I think it is time, whether it be through a, well, I mean, I'm doing it through a podcast, but it's not quite the same thing. But I know when you go on a general radio, you know, and if it's syndicated or it's already national anyway, people are going to hear it.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, do you think it's time for that to happen again, where maybe somebody once a month, or I'm asking you this only because I know you did radio and television, and maybe you have your own thoughts in this, whether you think it's time for this actually maybe to bring this up again. It doesn't have to be by Theo, but it could be any one of us doing this.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how that would look, and it's something I thought about.
Yeah.
Because I would like to do it. I like to think my career in broadcasting is not over.
Yeah.
As far as Theo goes, at the time I too did think it was great. He's just so infuriated me lately.
Yes.
That's so hard, yeah, that there was phenomenal. And Kyle Beach recently.
Yes, Kyle Beach, another one, exactly.
Yeah, Kyle Beach. And I did write an op-ed article about Kyle Beach.
And actually, I did read that, by the way.
Yeah, and so I do think there's a place for this, but I'm not sure what it would look like. Because, you say you don't want to come on every week and hear about another.
Yeah.
You see, I love the title of your show.
Yeah.
You know, because it's about progressing, it's about curing, it's about getting beyond it, and that's how I think that's the show that it's got to be. It's got to be something that is conversational.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be something that allows people to know that there is a progression through this. And personally, I would like it to be humorous, and I'm not sure how you possibly sell childhood sexual trauma as humorous.
I think there's a way, but that's something we'd have to talk about off air, because I have some amazing friends that put this into comedy.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, that would be really interesting to hear.
And I'm hoping that if you're at our conference coming up that you'll be there, and I'm hoping that James will be there as well, because I'll introduce someone who does comedy about this particular problem.
Oh, well, that's great.
Yeah.
I will be there because I'm a speaker there.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
So I will be there, and I look forward to meeting James. I worked at a comedy club for a while. I wonder if I might have met him through there.
It's quite possible. James Gangling is his name, and he...
I don't know that it's Yuck Yucks I worked at.
Yeah, that's where he started, and he's worked in the States and in Canada, and his career is going nicely.
Oh, this is wonderful. I look forward to meeting him.
So the reason why I asked you about the radio thing, I talked to you about the radio thing, just to mention it too, because there's a lady over in the United Kingdom who does this exactly once a week. It started off as a podcast, and now it's on regular radio. That's a woman.
I hope this happened to you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, but you brought up some very good points. And I mean, I could see myself talking about this once a month on national radio, and then having a topic. But I couldn't obviously see this doing this once a week, unless I included comedy and some other things. And, you know, you really got to mix it up so you want people coming back, because who wants to hear all this doom and gloom, right? And
you got to make it not doom and gloom.
Exactly.
And, you know what? And that is something the book, The Wild Boy of Wabamik, I wanted it to make it seem like it's not just doom.
Yeah.
It's a horrible, horrible thing.
Yeah.
But I still got to go swimming in my pool.
Yeah.
I still got to go to the drive-in. I still got to hang out with my friend Doug.
Yeah.
I mean, there, it's an ugly thing. I don't want to make it sound like anything else.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make it sound like, oh, come on, it wasn't your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the mind and the world doesn't stop, and I think it can for some people, but if they just realize that there is a way out of this, there is an end.
Mm-hmm.
And even while it's going on, there are avenues where you can distract yourself from things. I liken it to kids who live in war-torn countries,
mm-hmm.
where there's bombings and executions, and they live like shell sharks.
Yeah.
You know, but if you look at those kids and look at footage of these kids, they're still out playing in the rubble and the dirt and things like that.
Yeah.
There's a way to get, you know. So I did want to tell a story that said that it's not just all doom and gloom.
Mm.
There's ugly things hiding behind the beautiful things, but there's still beauty in the world.
I mean,
I might sound a bit naive, but
I wouldn't say so. No, I mean, just to what you're saying, like, I mean, I've read the book, and I love how you orchestrated it all the way through. Yeah, there's doom and gloom, but you put so much life and fun, and you didn't make it. Sure, it's bad, but it didn't sound so bad, right? And that's why I really enjoyed reading the book. It, like, I couldn't stop once I started.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So much. I kind of got off track here a little bit, but I do have a question for you. What do you think was the hardest part about writing this book for you?
I think the hardest part of writing this book for me was. I wanted the child's voice throughout.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I wanted the adult insight that a child could not have.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted the reader to experience this through the child's eyes, which is the fact that they don't necessarily know how traumatic this is
mm-hmm.
until later. And I wanted the insight of an adult who's going, this is messed up, you know? And so that's where the wild boy comes in.
Mm.
The wild boy, I didn't really have an imaginary person in my room talking to me. That was a literary creation of the memoir so that I could include my voice as an adult. So it was really, really hard to come up with that device because I kept saying, well, I want this innocence, but I really want them to know that this was also going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But only an adult could know this was going on.
Yeah.
And so that was the hardest part, finding that balance.
Yeah. So in your book, I'm gonna jump ahead a little bit further to when your life really starts to change, when you left home, when you went to university and college. And in your book, you talk about you coming home and dealing with your dad. That must be really hard for you. The reason why I'm saying this is because in the book you mentioned about how you're growing up, you're not, you know, you're in control of you now. And what was that like for you to be at that stage, or rather that age of independence, and being able to kind of walk away from that and feel that you have your own control of your life?
I don't think I did feel I had control of my life.
Mm.
And I think that's sort of revealed in the scene where I come home from a summer and I'm feeling in charge. I'm feeling confident. I've been treated well for an entire summer. I was respected and liked and admired even.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home a new guy, and it took 10 minutes for that to change.
Mm.
And I was always aware, I was always afraid of him.
Mm.
Right up until, until I stopped seeing him.
Mm.
Even there was an incident, and I don't think this made the book, but, it's hard to remember everything because it was in there at one time. It might still be in there.
Mm.
Where my father's sister died.
Yes, it is in there. Yes.
It is.
Yeah.
And I say something, you know, nice. Everybody else is, like, making him change the subject and stuff. Mm. And I say something nice, and he attacks me for it.
Mm.
And I just – and at a niece's wedding, I have long hair.
Like me.
You. And
yeah.
I think, yes, it was like that. And my dad, like, just, like, berated me
yeah.
At this wedding in front of people to the point where I was already living on my own in Toronto as a grown man
mm-hmm.
In my 20s. And I had to walk away because, I was going to start crying, and I certainly didn't want to do it there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I ever thought I had control mm-hmm. of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sensation is only hitting me now. And because if it wasn't my father, then it was the drugs. Then it was the, you know, promiscuity, mm-hmm. It was the alcohol, it was something else that had control.
Mm-hmm.
So a gatehouse really helped me recognize the need to take control and the need to sort of stand up for myself. I didn't even know what standing up for myself meant.
Mm-hmm. I can
but say. I'm going to say that I think that that is the toxic residue of the trauma, sexual trauma,
mm-hmm.
is the inability to... You lose yourself. Your
yeah.
it is gone. Your
yeah.
ego is gone,
yeah.
you know? Maybe you're all ego. I don't know. But
yeah, it's a combination of things. Your ego, your most importantly, your sense of identity to who you truly are, because I was gone
yeah.
when that stuff started happening. My experience, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here's another thing, too, to take it down, a little different slight of a path,
mm-hmm.
is, again, a therapist pointed out, what is also robbed from us, particularly if the abuser is male, and more often than not it is. I've run into a few gentlemen where it has been a woman,
mm-hmm.
And that pulls us.
I had that experience. I had that experience, which I often talked about.
And it and the people say, "Hey, lucky you."
Yeah.
You know, it's not lucky you.
No.
Right.
No.
Anyway, so when you know. As a male being abused 10 years by another male,
mm-hmm.
not just another male, your father.
Yeah.
What also was robbed for me was my sexual identity.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I was gay, there was no way I was going to
you know,
follow through on that path.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I wasn't given that right to find out on my own what my
yeah.
sexual identity is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's also other things. I wasn't given the right to mourn a father when he died, because when he died, I honestly, I don't care. I do care how this sounds, but I have to say it, I didn't care
yeah.
when he died.
Yeah, I get that.
And that's a terrible thing. I want to care. I want to be a man who experiences the loss of a mentor, of a father.
Mm.
That was taken from me,
mm.
you know, so
yeah,
I think I went on a little, you know, little excursion there that wasn't your intent, but
that's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right. You know, that's the beautiful thing about what we're doing here. So we can do that and get away with it. Right.
Mm.
We have nobody,
yeah.
we have nobody editing and cutting us. So we can do whatever and say whatever the hell we
there
want.
We go.
Right.
And you can sit at home and yell at a, you know,
yeah.
yell at your monitor or
yeah.
your iPod or whatever you're doing. I don't know.
And, you know, right to what you're saying, and I'm glad you said this, because this is so important, and I've heard this from so many people, and this is actually part of our program at the Gatehouse. We talk about sexuality. In my experience, I was abused on both sides, and it happened for many years, like yourself, more years than I care to even mention. But that left me with a great sense of confusion of my sexual identity. So I had to figure
mm-hmm.
that out. And I had to figure that out. I figured that out on my own before I went to the Gatehouse, but it took me a long time to figure that out.
Yeah.
Am I straight? Am I gay? What the hell am I?
Mm-hmm.
Where do I belong? Where do I fit in? Who do I trust? Right? I, you know, my level of trust, there was none there. So, you know, experimenting just probably made it worse, for heaven's sakes, right?
And you can't trust your instinct because
yes.
your instincts have been manipulated.
Yes.
Right? The body betrays you so
yes.
easily.
Yeah.
And so you're going, well, you know, people say, well, if you aren't gay, then you wouldn't have responded. That's
bullshit.
Crap.
Bullshit.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a whole kettle of fish.
It is.
It
is.
talk about an old expression.
Yeah.
It's just not easy. I'm not comparing the gift. I mean, you and I have been abused 10 years plus.
Yeah.
I know people, the guy that threw up the table, I found out that, you know, he was hit on once. And my mind goes, that's nothing. Well, it is something.
It
caused that reaction, right?
Yeah.
So it is something. So it's not a comparable. I tend to think, come on, a decade, that's going to have more effect. Maybe not. I don't know.
Mm.
Maybe once is all it takes. Mm. But when something has been embedded in you constantly, and you're told, well, in my case, I was told that if people found out, our name would be Mud, which was, you know,
yeah,
you know, I didn't want that. And your sense of identity, which you don't have,
mm-hmm.
and going through that, can you imagine? It's one thing going through your puberty years and trying to figure out whether you're straight or gay,
mm-hmm.
but going through your adult years and trying to figure it out, it's excruciating. And it's horrifying, and you don't know who you're betraying. Are you betraying yourself? Are you betraying others? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it comes right down to our own personal betrayal because we're confused from it. It's really what it comes down to.
Yes, that's right. we can't even trust, as I said before, our instinct. We can't even trust our reactions to certain things because
we have
been manipulated.
Yeah, we just don't know. It's not true. You know, but, you know, that was a really hard time for me when I think about it. When I was in Saskatchewan going to university many, many years ago, that was a hard time for me. I had a really hard time going to school dealing with that. That really, really messed me up. Trying to be an adult and trying to be responsible. And then it's just one thing after another. Things that I thought I had under control, I did not have under control. We are moving on here. I realize the time is going on. So, and I don't want to keep you here from your day too much longer. And I really do appreciate your time here. And I'm really looking forward to our next conversation moving forward. But, excuse me. So what would you tell somebody wanting to go out with their story? And I don't like using that word story, but their experience, I should say, about childhood sexual abuse. What would you tell somebody wanting to come forward about this? And I'm not saying that they should come forward and write a book or go on TV or anything, but what would you say to somebody wanting to come forward and to actually wanting to do with this right on, head right on, right?
The very first thing I would tell them to do is to get in contact with Gatehouse. Because I do think, and this sounds like I'm doing a what do you call those TV commercials that...
An ad.
An
or
ad
plug.
For you, but...
Yeah.
Plug, but it truly is a good place to start, and particularly for young people because it's peer-driven, and I think and then you will find like-minded or like-experienced people. So I would definitely encourage people to if they want to talk about it, I would say yes, that you've come to a point of your healing because it takes you have to heal a lot before you're even ready to talk about it. I think you have to heal a lot before you even come to the point where you can admit it to yourself
mm-hmm.
that it's happened.
Yeah.
So I would encourage people. I think also I would encourage them to make sure that they do so in a safe environment. I wouldn't suggest that they confront their abuser, not without full knowledge of the situation, of where they are, of maybe sort of trying to think about the reaction that they might get. It could be ugly.
Mm-hmm.
I would maybe warn them that they do need to come forward. If they've got to that point where they want to, then they need to. But don't necessarily expect everyone's going to respond the same way. I would warn them of that. My sister, I told when I was 19, I didn't have any concept of the kind of impact that would have on her. And of course it did. And she went to her church It was a church. I don't know why I did the finger quote. Mm. But she went to a church and talked to her minister. And the minister advised her. I was 19 at the time, and I told her about this, and I told her that I wanted to come forward, et cetera. And the minister advised her that I should not go forward with this because there's a good chance I wouldn't be believed. And so I kept quiet for another 20 or 30 years, you know?
Wow.
So not everyone's reaction is going to be the same.
Yeah.
So I would definitely advise someone to tell, to talk about it, to find a safe place to talk about it. The gatehouse is a wonderful place to talk about it if your abuser's still alive and if you think they're still active. The police are a good place to go talk about it. But don't necessarily expect that everyone is going to be open arms about it.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I'm really glad you said that because it's so. And one of the biggest things I had to learn in this process about talking about it is you just can't tell anybody. You have to trust that person first before you do, especially in your own experience anyway,
yeah,
in order for it to get that kind of support. But you
yeah.
know what? Being from where I was and how I grew up, I had to figure that out the hard way.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't have to, but I did not know. But now I know, and that's why I'm saying this, that anybody wanting to come forward, really, really be careful who you pick and choose. So to tell the story to, because if you're not careful, it'll come back and haunt you in ways you never saw it coming.
Yeah. And that's it. Yeah. And so pick someone maybe who is a professional at this level or somebody can, but even then, like, did I tell my cousins in the book, did I tell them and they were phoned my mother to say, hey, this is going on, and my mother freaked out? Or did, according to my mother, they phoned to say I was disrespecting my father? You know, I'm not so sure that is what they said to them. They very well could have been talking to my mom and saying, this is what's happening with your husband. And she decided to turn that around. So you do have to be so, so careful.
Oh, yeah. You know, and one point, too, to add to this as well, I mean, just show how much things have changed, because I remember telling my biological mother, I wasn't raised by my mother, but we would see her from time to time, but I remember telling my biological mother back in the late 60s, and you know where that went to? Nowhere. Nowhere.
What was her response?
Well, I was pretty young at the time, but I remember my response. The only response I think I really remember to this day is the expression on her face. And she did not know what to tell me other than remember the exact conversation, what she said. But other than, I think it was shocked. And, you know, for all I know, she could have had the same experience, you know, because my mother was ridden with trauma from the past. And I have no idea because I don't know her story. You know, she was adopted as well. And, you know, she came up from Nova Scotia up to Ontario through the pipeline. I have no idea. But I'm sure, I'm almost 100% sure of it to this day that she had abuse as well. But, no, I think she just did not handle it, to be honest with you. And what could she do? I mean, maybe she did tell somebody. She did. I never would have knew about it. So,
right.
But nowadays, you can do that, and you can find people that you can trust to do that, is my point, right?
Yeah, I there is, and there's organizations in place, and also people are talking about it.
Yeah.
So you do know, and the people that I first went to, I mean, other than the ones that in the book, were women who wrote books about their own abuse. So like Sylvia Frazier wrote a book called My Father's House. And I was in correspondence to her as well.
Well, folks, we are getting on to that time. It's amazing how time just flies. I mean, I could probably talk to you easily for another 2 hours. Wouldn't think nothing of it. But unfortunately, our days are moving on. We've got things to do. And I got work to do, too, as well. As I am an employee of the Gatehouse, and I have to get back to my responsibilities. But first, Tom, would you mind plugging yourself right now? So where can we buy your book?
Oh, thank you. So it's The Wild Boy of Wabamunak. I'm showing you this now.
Yeah.
There you go. And those who are listening and not watching it, it's WAUBAMIK. So you can order through Dundurn Press, just like Dundurn Press, D-U-N-D-U-R-N, Press, just Google it. Also, Amazon has it. I would phone to Indigo, demand that they bring that book into the store.
Absolutely.
And a lot of independent books. I know Book City has it. You know, just phone up a bookstore and say you would like to have this book. And I think if enough people do that, they'll start bringing the books into the stores. Independent bookstores have it in the store, like Wordsworth and Kitchener-Waterloo has it. Book City and Flying Books have it in Toronto. Perry Sound Books have it up in Perry Sound.
Mm.
So any of those places, or Dundurn Press, whatever. I would be so grateful for every person that is able to pick it up. And if you do end up going to the conference and you have a copy, God, I'd be thrilled to sign it for you.
Looking forward to that. Looking forward to that. And because anybody who's looked into our conference, just so you know, we have a few authors are there, and actually there'll be two male authors there, yourself and another one. So I'm really looking forward to that. Folks, I really want to thank you for joining myself and Tom here today. And hopefully you got something out of it that'll help you help yourself. What can I say other than thank you? And I really look forward to speaking with you again. And Tom, if you wouldn't mind holding on for a minute while I just we'll sign us off, would that be all right?
Oh, yeah. I'm here as long as you need me.
Okay, so folks, so I'm on this book review thing. So my next guest is going to be and book I'll be reading is called The Cult Child, and it's by Vinny Costas. So my friends out there in Twitter land, they'll know who I'm talking about, especially when I'm talking about Vinny. But Vinny will be my next guest, talking about her book, Child Cult, or rather Cult Child, I should say. And I got to read this yet, but in all due fairness, I'll have to read it before I talk to her. I've already communicated with her, so I'm hoping that sometime in May that I can get her on here and we can talk about this, about her book as well. Folks, I want to bid you a good day, and actually, it's only Monday, so I'll bid you a good week, not even the weekend, because we just got over it. Tom, I can't thank you enough for being here on Personal Transformation and sharing your thoughts, your insights, and sharing about your story about your book, or your experiences about your book moving forward. And I wish you all a good day, folks. Thank you. And stay tuned for the next show. Now I'm just going to sign off here. Oops. Apologies.